This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates that relate to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wild lands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Eric Mulvar. He's Executive Director of the Western Watersheds Project, a nonprofit conservation group dedicated to protecting and restoring wildlife and watersheds throughout the American West. Eric is a wildlife biologist with scientific research in behavioral ecology and systems ecology of moose, and has spent 10 years as an author of guidebooks to national parks and wilderness areas, including one about Wyoming's Red Desert. He's been a conservation professional for 21 years, working first in the Bureau of Land Management Wilderness Inventory and later on oil and gas issues, sage-grouse conservation, large carnivore defense, land use planning, and livestock issues.
Welcome back, Eric. It's good to be talking with you again. Got some more questions for you. We didn't finish last week, but here we go. You advocate something called environmentally protective grazing regulations. Would you talk about that?
Sure. Right now, we have livestock grazing leases that typically authorize the rancher to graze off 50 to 65% of the total forage production. That's all the forage that grows between January 1st of a given year and December 31st. The cattle get half or more of that. That leaves for the mule deer, for the elk, for the jackrabbits, for the mice, for anything else, for the Mormon crickets and grasshoppers that are going to eat that grass. That leaves less than half of the grass remaining. And then the grass has to have enough energy to survive the winter and resprout in the spring again. And the result of all of these years of heavy chronic overgrazing has been to wipe out those perennial bunch grasses and allow for massive cheatgrass infestations that are now spreading over hundreds of millions of acres. That's a major disaster. What we need to do first is we need to reform the amount of livestock grazing that is authorized on Western public lands and cap it at an absolute maximum of 30%. That is the level at which the range management textbooks from the ag schools of the American West have established as the most you can graze without causing damage to the land and the vegetation. Yet the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management are chronically authorizing more grazing than this, sometimes double or more grazing than this, and they're damaging the land. And we need to take that back. Also, we're trying to get large core areas around that already have some kind of protection, like national monuments or wilderness areas or national parks, and get all of the livestock grazing out of those areas through voluntary grazing permit buyouts so that the ranchers can monetize grazing permits that might no longer be profitable to them, and conservation can get areas that are free from livestock grazing and are allowed to recover to reestablish the native vegetation and the abundant native wildlife. And what a lot of people don't realize is that when you put a large amount of cattle out on land in the American West, it's not just the grasses that you're hurting. A lot of times those ranchers are going to try to get rid of a lot of other species of native wildlife. They want to get rid of the wolves. They want to get rid of the grizzly bears. They want to get rid of the coyotes. They want to get rid of the prairie dogs. They want to get rid of the beavers. And they have all kinds of different programs to get rid of them. They even, you know, when the elk and the mule deer get abundant, the livestock industry will try to get the state government to have what they call a depredation hunt so that they can hunt down the number of elk and decrease the total population of elk so that they're not competing with their cattle. And recently in Wyoming, there were bills in the Wyoming legislature. I don't believe they passed, but they were proposing that any elk grazing on private land that ate up 15% of the annual forage production constituted overgrazing by elk, and therefore would trigger a depredation hunt to knock their numbers back.
Talk about bison grazing on and what the effect of the bison grazing is, and particularly on tribal lands as well as public lands.
Well, bison graze the land very much differently from cattle. And bison, when they're out there on the landscape in the arid west, they're grazing far away from water. They can range up onto steep terrain. There have been some interesting studies done in Henry Mountains of Utah that show that they really have a contrasting grazing style, whereas cattle evolved in the boggy forests of northern Europe. And so they concentrate their grazing right along the stream sides, and they tend to wipe out the willows along the stream.
Yeah.
They tend to trample the banks. They tend to cause erosion. They tend to pollute the waterways with fecal coliform from their manure, and
right.
They cause huge amounts of problems. So bison are by far and away not only the native grazer in North America, but an ecologically preferable grazer in North America. Now, right now, many tribes are establishing bison herds on their reservations. And the National Park Service in Yellowstone, when bison try to leave the park to go to their traditional winter ranges outside the park, the Park Service has been actively trying to pen them into the national park. And when their numbers get too numerous, instead of letting them spread out on
right.
other public lands
right.
surrounding Yellowstone, they've been authorizing hunts for those bison outside the park, just right along the park boundary, but
right.
also trapping and removing those bison, and then in some cases relocating them onto tribal reservations. Now, on those tribal reservations, sometimes the bison are managed as wild bison, and they're allowed to range freely, and that's the ideal situation.
Mm-hmm.
And in other cases, when the tribes get a bison herd started out of these Yellowstone bison, sometimes they manage them as livestock, which is certainly better than running cattle on the same ground because of the ecological advantages. So even that is better than having cattle, but it's certainly not quite as good for the land as having free wild bison on the reservation, as they do in some places.
So does Western Watersheds then advocate for bison roaming wild on national forest land?
WWP has been for many years advocating that the Park Service and the Forest Service allow the Yellowstone bison to roam freely throughout all of the public lands surrounding the Yellowstone National Park. And if they did, in fact, allow the bison to spread out and move down the valley into some of those traditional winter ranges, then those bison would be able to sustain a larger population in Yellowstone as a whole without having the overgrazing damage to the same extent as we have today by bottling them up inside the park.
Could they also be located in wildlife refuges?
Absolutely. Western Watersheds Project even now has been advocating for returning bison to wildlife refuges like Red Rock Lakes Wildlife Refuge down near the Centennial Mountains in Montana. And we think that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service should stop grazing any livestock on wildlife refuges,
mm-hmm.
and if they believe that they need some kind of large herbivore, they should be grazing bison there as wild, free-roaming wildlife.
Why are bison not already on the C.M. Russell Wildlife Refuge up in north-central Montana?
Well, certainly the American Prairie Organization has been reintroducing bison to a lot of private lands near
right.
the C.M. Russell. But I think one of the reasons that you don't see wild bison starting on the C.M. Russell is that the state of Montana has been aggressively trying to limit the amount of areas where bison occur as wild, free-roaming wildlife. And that's just wrong. They shouldn't be doing that. Bison are native to Montana. They're native wildlife, just like elk, just like bighorn sheep. We don't see the state of Montana trying to pen up mule deer and Custer County, for example, and preventing them from leaving the county. It's a bit ridiculous from a wildlife management standpoint to try and pen up a species of native wildlife in one little postage stamp of habitat, particularly one like Yellowstone, which doesn't contain suitable winter range.
Do you think there's any possibility politically for bison to be reintroduced to the CMR and other wildlife refuges in Montana?
the political worm always turns. And just because we have a state government that's very hostile to bison today doesn't mean that in 10 or 20 years we might not have a governor and a legislature that's fully supportive of restoring bison throughout the state.
Well, the
cattle industry is really the industry that is blocking bison recovery.
Right.
They're doing that out of what we think is a fairly misguided and misplaced fear of a disease called brucellosis.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the National Academy of Sciences put out a report in 2017 that found that of all the times that brucellosis has been transmitted from wildlife to cattle, not once has the culprit ever been bison. Every transmission to cattle from wildlife has come from elk-wildlife interactions. And the ranchers that surround Yellowstone, they have started to get wise to this, and they are starting to put up large, tall fences to keep the elk out of their hay and keep them out of their winter feed lines. And by keeping the elk separated from their cattle on private land, they are able to preclude the transmission of any diseases from the elk to the cattle, or for the elk, from the cattle to the elk.
Right.
So that's the solution that all the ranchers should be kind of putting in place anyway. And if they do this, then the threat from bison is also negligible.
And what's your take on wild horses on public lands?
Western Watersheds Project is somewhat neutral on the issue of wild horses. And we see ourselves mainly as, you know, kind of an organization that likes to tell the truth about the issue and poke holes in the fictions that the livestock industry likes to spread. So our, we have a formal board-approved thinking about the species, which goes something like this. The species Equus caballus originally evolved in North America, but went extinct on this continent around 5,900 years ago. Most paleontologists believe that today's wild horses date from escapees from the Spanish colonies in the 1500s and were then augmented over time by more recent escapees from farms and ranches. On the other hand, an ethnographic study of indigenous oral history supports the concept that horses might already have been present throughout North America prior to the arrival of European immigrants. Like cattle, elk, or any other herbivore, wild horses can damage the range in cases where they become overpopulated. Western Watersheds Project supports the Wild and Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act, which directs federal agencies to maintain wild horses within, quote, a thriving natural ecological balance, unquote. This is a standard that ought to be applied to domestic livestock as well, but it is not. In terms of overall numbers, there are an estimated 5,900 wild horses on Western public lands at present, compared to about 1.6 million cattle. The livestock industry and federal agencies disseminate misinformation about wild horses in an effort to distract public and media attention away from the much more serious and widespread environmental problems caused by domestic cattle and sheep on Western public lands. And WWP endeavors to correct the record based on the best available science. So that's kind of our standpoint on wild horses. And it's a running battle with the livestock industry and its apologists to keep the industry from spreading fictions about wild horses and blaming wild horses for landscape degradation that's actually caused by domestic cattle and sheep.
Isn't there a Western Wildlands team in Oregon that's advocating for the responsible management and protection of native species and their habitat in Oregon, including wild horses?
Well, it's absolutely true that Western Watersheds Project has an Oregon office, and that office has spearheaded our efforts to protect beavers nationwide.
Uh-huh.
We did present President Biden with an executive order that would close all public lands to beaver hunting and trapping to help the beaver rebound throughout the American West, and that would be a huge benefit, not just to waterways and to trout streams and fish populations, but also overall, it would hold a lot more water on the land and keep it from running off and make the vegetation communities in those riparian bottomlands a lot more lush and productive for biodiversity. So that's one item. We are intervening in a wild horse gather called the Kiger Riddle Gather in Oregon, where the Bureau of Land Management is gathering off wild horses at the same time as they authorize much more abundant and dense populations of cattle on the same lands. And They haven't even bothered to do an assessment of what the landscape health is in that area. So we are taking them to court to get them to do their due diligence there. Also in Oregon, we're fighting to try and protect the Owyhee Canyon lands area in southeastern Oregon, and also to establish a large core area of protected habitat around the Hart Mountain and Sheldon National Wildlife Refuge areas. So there are a lot of things going on in Oregon. We're also trying to protect mountain lions and bighorn sheep in that state.
Uh-huh.
And protecting wolves as they expand into Oregon has been a running battle.
Uh-huh. So what kind of lobbying does Western Watersheds do? Do you lobby state legislatures? And in what states, or do you even lobby in Washington, D.C.?
WWP very rarely lobbies in state legislatures because that's a very time and energy intensive endeavor. You almost
right.
have to have a full-time lobbyist in the
yeah.
legislature to even know what's going on from day to day. But we do send our teams of professionals to Washington, D.C. We do lobby Congress on behalf of environmental initiatives. One of our favorites right now is Senator Booker's Tribal Heritage and American Bison, Wolf, and Grizzly Bear Protection and Restoration Act. That's an act that was patterned after the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act and would treat those three species, bison, wolves, and grizzly bears, just like we now treat eagles. In other words, you're not allowed to kill them. You're not allowed to possess their parts unless you're a tribal member. And that really, for eagles, has supported a major rebound, particularly for bald eagles across the country in the wake of that big population decline that was due to DDT, but also was due to ranchers shooting eagles because they were worried about them attacking their livestock.
So is your major effort with the public through the courts?
I would say that our legal actions through the courts are a backbone of our work. It is absolutely necessary if you are going to try to influence the outcomes of federal decisions to take them to court and prove that you can stop them from doing things that are illegal. Otherwise, they will keep on approving illegal actions and violating environmental standards until the cows come home.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, in a lot of the West, the cows never come home. So it's pretty hopeless if you don't have a legal component. We also, in addition to the lobbying work that we do a lot of work with the media to try and educate the public through press releases and opinion editorials and
mm-hmm.
appearing on documentaries and in television news stories. We also do a little bit of grassroots organizing. That's not our big strength, but we occasionally do it, as we did in Point Reyes National Seashore earlier when we helped turn the tide of public opinion away from the idea that we should have cattle on the seashore, keeping the elk penned up on that waterless peninsula.
All right.
And, you know, so we have a lot of different kind of strategies and tactics. And the legal part of it is a big part of it. I think the last time I checked, which was a couple of weeks ago, we had 46 active cases currently under litigation.
So wow.
That's the way to hold these agencies accountable.
I guess.
Is to stop them in court or force them to the bargaining table and sign settlements.
Do you encourage renewable energy, windmills and solar panels on public lands?
At WWP, we think that renewable energy is the energy of the future, but we should be citing it as solar panels inside urban areas on top of disturbed landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
If we can be putting photovoltaic panels on the roofs of all of the available buildings, on shade canopies above parking lots, shading our existing large irrigation aqueducts. These are areas that don't have any habitat value. We don't see it as a good idea to have large utility-scale industrial projects out on public lands wiping out habitat for sage grouse or desert tortoises.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a trade-off that doesn't need to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We have a climate crisis that we need to solve. We also have a biodiversity crisis that we need to solve. If we don't solve either one of them, our species, in the end, is going to face real problems, maybe even go extinct. So we shouldn't be trading off the biodiversity crisis and sacrificing biodiversity in the name of advancing climate change gains if we can go ahead and, as scientific studies suggest, produce all the electricity the country needs from rooftops we already have.
And what about oil and gas drilling? Do you allow it in any locations, just on private land, or you oppose it on public lands all over?
Western Watersheds Project focuses pretty exclusively on public lands, and on public lands and those minerals that are owned by the federal government, those are public minerals too. And we don't think that it makes any sense at all to lease those minerals to the oil and gas industry or the coal industry to have those carbon molecules pumped out of the ground or mined out of the ground and burned and put up into the atmosphere. Because the taxpayers are paying for billions of dollars of disaster reclamation. The fires in Los Angeles that are raging right now, I heard a news report yesterday that said that the cost of those fires, which are climate change driven, those Santa Ana winds are fiercer than they used to be.
Right.
The area is drier and hotter than it used to be. Those fires are bigger than any fire has ever been in Los Angeles because of climate change. And the public is going to end up footing the bill. So we think that the oil and gas deposits and the coal deposits on public land, we ought to keep them in the ground where they belong. That's safely sequestered carbon. That's what's in the public interest. Allowing some profit-driven industry to pump them out and enrich themselves and impoverish the rest of the country paying for these giant disasters, whether they're wildfires or they're big hurricanes or big tornadoes or other climate-related events that are exacerbated by fossil fuels consumption, that does not make any public policy or economic sense at all.
What about agricultural use? Do you favor particular crops or discourage any types of agriculture?
Most crop agriculture happens on private lands, and we really don't do much on private lands. It is certainly true that for farming, the monoculture method of large-scale industrial agriculture creates ecological wastelands that are not of any use to native wildlife species. And that's something that could be improved upon by implementing regenerative farming. On the other hand, when you try to apply the regenerative idea to livestock grazing, the only way to get there is to reduce the number of your cattle or sheep so they're not as dense on the landscape. That's the only way that you can get the land to recover. There are these fictional kinds of schemes called the savory grazing method or rotational grazing that is promoted as being regenerative, but in reality, it's just a different way to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic as you sink the ship of healthy lands and healthy ecosystems.
You partner with some other organizations. What are those, and how do you go about doing the partnership arrangement?
Western Watersheds Project partners with different organizations on different issues where our priorities and our interests and our expertise intersects with those other organizations. So we have a coalition that works on sage grouse. We have a coalition that works on to reform wildlife services, the agency that's the death squad for the ag industry to wipe out native wildlife populations that are inconvenient to ag. We've got a coalition that works on the Southern Rockies. We've got a coalition that works on environmental justice issues. And each of these different coalitions have a different suite of partners. Now, there are certain organizations that are out there, organizations like Wild Earth Guardians, Center for Biological Diversity, Alliance for the Wild Rockies, that think about environmental protection in much the same way that we do, and we often ally ourselves with organizations like these.
Do you have attorneys on your staff, or do the organizations you partner with have their attorneys, or do you go outside to find an attorney to work with you?
Right now, Western Watersheds Project has two full-time litigating attorneys on staff that are taking cases for us and winning cases for us. And we also are partnering with pro bono attorney shops like Western Environmental Law Center and Advocates for the West and Earth Justice to advance our lawsuits. So really, we have a variety of different staffing for our different lawsuits, and we often have coalition partners that join us in our lawsuit. So it's not just WWP typically on a lawsuit. It's unusual. Sometimes happens. But it's usually we're partnering up with other organizations because we're stronger in numbers, and we can be more resilient as a coalition.
Right. How do you get public support?
Western Watersheds Project is entirely funded through public donations, and large donors are our primary bread and butter. That's where we live or die on our funding, and so far, so good. We have had very generous donors over the years that have enabled us to grow at a steady and sustainable pace, and the donations have kept pace with that. And I think one of the reasons that our fundraising has been successful is that we've been able to produce an unusual number of conservation victories that are really important and high profile that people have heard of and know about. Everything from bear's ears to wolves to grizzly bears. And certainly for those people who are concerned about the impacts of cattle and sheep on Western public lands, we're the primary group that works on that. So those folks tend to come our way.
What's your website?
Western Watersheds website is www.westernwatersheds.org, and you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, and I believe that we are starting on Mastodon and also on Blue Sky.
Oh, wow. That's great. Okay, well, we've run out of time again, but I really appreciate all that you've told us. This has been terrific. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, good. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour presentation and interviews, go online to kgvm.org and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife, where you see a large number of interviews from which to choose. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Okay, Eric, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay. We've had another great day of wearing out my vocal cords.
you're very good. You're very good to interview. I really learn a lot, and I appreciate your willingness to do it.
So, you bet. Anytime.
I'll send you the raw, unedited copy, and down the line, it'll come up on our website or the KGOM website, and you can listen to it edited if you want to pass it around.
Okay, yeah. I think also make sure that you send us those hot links from once they get posted online, because we do like to share those around, and then
right.
Folks can find your website.
Will do. Okay, Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
All right, take care. Bye.
All right.
Our guest today has been Eric Melvar, Executive Director of the Western Watersheds Project, a nonprofit conservation group dedicated to protecting and restoring wildlife and watersheds throughout the American West. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. If you'd like to know more about GWA, go to its website at gallatinwildlife.org and see what is being done to conserve America's wildlife. To hear more of these half-hour presentations and interviews, go online to kgvm.org and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife, where you'll see a large number of interviews from which to choose. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.